It's a reconvening, and we've switched panel. And now to my right is Justice Dauphineau, Justice Gardner on my left, and I'm Bill Meyer, and I'll be presiding judge today for the rest of the cases that are on our docket. And so if the council is present and we're ready to proceed, then I'd ask the clerk to call the roll, and we'll go to our next case. Mr. Herman.
May it please the court. This case presents, in my opinion, an issue of first impression for cases decided under the Texas Open Meetings Act. So it's novel in that respect. And it's novel because the plaintiff below, Mr. Bennett, asked that the courts apply Texas Open Meeting Act requirements in circumstances where the legislature had previously determined that the Texas Open Meetings Act requirements were inapplicable. The precise point is this. In the Water Code, the legislature has said that a water district, such as Tarrant Regional Water District, may go about its business through the use of committees. And the legislature has said that committee activities of a water district are exempt from the requirements of the Texas Open Meetings Act. The exemption is plain and unambiguous. Notwithstanding this language, Mr. Bennett contends that Tarrant Regional Water District's use of committees, or a committee in particular, has somehow violated the Texas Open Meeting Act requirements. So the question that's raised is, how can committee activities violate Texas Open Meetings Act requirements when, in fact, by legislative edict, the Texas Open Meeting Act is not applicable to the activities? It's a novel charge, but it's not complicated. Just a brief background, if I may. This case concerns what's called the Integrated Pipeline Project. It is a very, very large project under which Tarrant Regional Water District, along with its partner, the Dallas Water District, is planning, designing, and ultimately constructing a water pipeline that will run from Lake Palestine in East Texas to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, ultimately Benbrook Lake. The project is publicly reported as a $2 billion project. It has been in the works already for at least 6 or 7 years. When the project is finished, the goal is to provide 350 million gallons of water per day to the citizens of Dallas, Fort Worth, and surrounding municipalities. It is generally regarded as one of the most significant economic development projects underway in North Texas and perhaps in the state of Texas. The plaintiff, Mr. Bennett, is a Dallas resident. And Mr. Bennett owns an exotic wildlife sanctuary in the area in East Texas near Lake Palestine. And at least according to current plans, the water pipeline will pass through and under Mr. Bennett's wildlife sanctuary. And he doesn't care for that. His interest, by virtue of this lawsuit, has little to do with transparency of government or protection of public policy. His interest has everything to do with delaying and, if at all possible, stopping ultimately the construction of the pipeline. The suit was originally filed in, I think, March of 2013, a couple of months ahead of a board election for Tarrant Regional Water District board members. And it was used in political advertisement. The existence of the suit was used in political advertisement to support particular candidates that were challenging for positions on the Regional Water Board. Mr. Bennett, quite frankly, and I think openly, hoped to gain control of the board by financially sponsoring a slate of candidates. That said, the suit is what it is. And the Regional Water District has responded to the suit by filing a plea to the jurisdiction.
Mr. Herman.
Yes.
You didn't mention the outcome of the election.
Well, the outcome of the election was one of Mr. Bennett's, one of the candidates sponsored by Mr. Bennett's, by Mr. Bennett was successful. And other board members.
There are still five board members, aren't there?
There are five
board members. And so the one board member that was elected didn't switch the majority.
That's correct.
Thank you.
The plea to the jurisdiction that has been filed by the Regional Water District raises essentially two fundamental points. Number one is the issue of immunity. As this court well knows, the Regional Water District is a governmental entity that is immune from suit unless there is an express and unambiguous waiver of that immunity. The second fundamental point is one that relates to subject matter jurisdiction and touches on two or three points. One is that the relief that Mr. Bennett has sought in the trial court is not relief that the trial court could grant. So the trial court does not have jurisdiction to grant the requested relief. Another is that Mr. Bennett has failed to join indispensable parties who would necessarily be affected by the declarations that he's seeking. And the third is that some of the claims are almost certainly moot. On the immunity issue, Mr. Bennett's contention is that the immunity of the Regional Water District has been waived by virtue of the Texas Open Meetings Act provision that allows for waiver of immunity. This runs headlong into the issue that I started with, which is how can immunity be waived under a statute where the legislature has predetermined that the particular statute is inapplicable to the circumstance at hand? Can it be said that the Regional Water District sovereign immunity has been waived by a provision in the Open Meetings Act when indeed the legislature has told us the Open Meetings Act does not apply? I submit that that's a very easy issue to resolve, and it cannot be. And indeed, I think Mr. Bennett is asking for nothing more or less than the courts to simply substitute their judgment, its judgment, for the judgment of the legislature, and we all know that that is inappropriate. The plain language of the Water Code says the Open Meetings Act provisions do not apply to the activities that are being challenged here, and that language controls the outcome in this instance. And the trial court should have found that the waiver, that immunity had not been waived, and should have dismissed this case based on the concept of sovereign immunity. Just as a matter of record fact, and just to be clear, the exemption that's granted to committee activities in the Water District does not apply if more than a quorum of the members of the board serve on a particular committee. And I just want to clear one thing up. The pleadings and maybe the arguments seem to contend that there are multiple committees at work here. There's only a single committee, which is the Construction and Operations Committee of the Water District. There are no legal committees or other committees that Mr. Bennett purports to identify. But the record in the case shows that in no instance did the Construction and Operations Committee of the Water District have in attendance a quorum or more than a quorum of the directors. At most, only two of the five directors would be present. And that's in the King affidavit and the Allen Thomas affidavits, and those affidavits have not been contested in connection with this proceeding. Finally, as a footnote on the immunity point, Mr. Bennett also argues, I think somewhat half-heartedly, that the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act contains a waiver of immunity. That is simply not true. And the Supreme Court in the CEFCIC case, the fairly recent CEFCIC case, makes it clear that in a case under the Declaratory Judgment Act, if there is a question of immunity, there must be a separate and independent basis for there to be a finding of waiver of immunity. The theory that Mr. Bennett urges, again, contending that the Open Meetings Act requirements apply, the theory of misconduct that he urges here is that the Water District Board delegated its responsibility to the Construction and Operations Committee, and that the Construction and Operations Committee actually performed the significant work of the board, and that the board acted only as a rubber stamping organization for the conduct of the committee. And Mr. Bennett's counsel has submitted several cases and a couple of cases and more attorney general opinions that deal with the concept of rubber stamping and whether a governmental board is merely rubber stamping the activities of a committee such that the committee becomes a governmental body. It is an interesting theory, but it has the same problem as the previous theory on immunity. The rubber stamping theory and the governmental body theory flow from the Texas Open Meetings Act requirements. And if the legislature has said, as it plainly has, that the Texas Open Meeting Act requirements do not apply to the activities of the Construction and Operations Committee, then any theory of governmental body analysis or rubber stamping that finds its source in the Texas Open Meetings Act is equally inapplicable to the analysis. So that, for example, in the Willman case, which they place heavy reliance on, where I believe it was the city of San Antonio was selecting municipal judges, and the court concluded that perhaps the committee assigned to review the applicants for municipal court positions, that its decisions were used for controlling decisions, and that the city council merely rubber stamped those decisions. What if in that case the legislature had said, but the Texas Open Meeting Act requirements and the Texas Open Meeting Act analyses do not apply to the circumstances of committees assisting in the identification of municipal judges? then that case would be like our case. And then the result in that case would have been, or certainly should have been, sorry, we're not going to make these activities subject to the Open Meetings Act requirement because we, the courts, are not going to second guess the policy decisions that the legislature has made for whatever purposes it chose. So the rubber stamping theory, in my mind, adds nothing. The second point of the plea to the jurisdiction, and I'll go very quickly, has to do with whether the trial court had the authority, the jurisdiction, to even grant the relief that the plaintiffs seek. In the first instance, and in their current pleadings, the plaintiffs asked for all activities of the board to be declared void and voidable without specifying any particular activity to be voided or declared voidable. The Open Meetings Act, on the other hand, says an action, i.e. a specific action, may be challenged and declared void or voidable. But as the case of Port Isabel School District tells us, that doesn't mean that a meeting may be declared void or voidable. It doesn't mean that a collective group of actions may be declared void or voidable. It means that if a plaintiff chooses to do so, he may challenge an action and pursue the analysis of the open meetings, satisfaction of the Open Meetings Act requirements. I see that my time is up. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. And if you would, please, ma'am, let's add a couple of minutes to Mr. Smith's presentation, and Mr. Smith will hear from you now.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. And thank you for granting oral argument. We obviously believe that this is a very important issue. We heard that this presents a question of first impression, and with all due respect to my colleague, we believe that the reason that is a question of first impression is because it's a very tortured reading and analysis of what the law actually is.
Smith, I want to stop you for a moment and say to you, as you start your discussion here, that I have a circumstance about me as a member of this panel that I want you to know about, and that is Mr. Herman's well aware of this because I've known him for a very long time, but I served in the legislature for a number of years some time back and actively worked on some of this legislation dealing with the Open Meetings Act, and I want you to know that in representing your client as you go into this, that I'm only the only one of the 98 appellate judges who actually served in the legislature. So you don't have this happen very often, but it does happen whenever I sit on the panel, and I want you to know that as you approach your argument, and so you'd have the benefit of understanding that as you make your presentation today.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. We heard a lot in the opening presentation in terms of discussion about committees and committee action. And that's certainly important, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But what we really didn't hear so much here was the claims asserted with respect to actions by board members. There was the illusion of rubber stamping, and that's certainly an important issue. But what we've really alleged here in terms of claims is violations of the Texans Open Meeting Act by the district and its board members. And in particular, what's been alleged is specifically over the course of 60 board meetings, which were conducted between March of 2009 and December of 2012, there were 239 actions considered. And out of those 239 actions, 329, get my numbers backwards. Out of 329 issues considered, all 329 were adopted unanimously. And as we've alleged, it was done so without open discussion, debate, and deliberation. And in the context of board action taken overtly without that type of dialogue, which poses the core basis or a fundamental purpose for TOMA, which is to give the public the benefit of those discussions, the dialogue, the debates, and an understanding for why decisions are being made. When the public was robbed of that and done so in a way where all 329 decisions were made with unanimity, it certainly raises the question, how in the world could five separately elected board members come to consensus, unanimous consensus, again and again and again, indeed in every single instance, without having in advance of the meeting discussed, deliberated, and arrived at those private decisions? That's what we've alleged. In the case of immunity, there's no dispute that I've heard thus far that there's not a legislative waiver of immunity in the case of claims against the district or against board members. That's just not in dispute. Clearly, immunity is waived as to that. To try to drive deeper, though, and create an issue where an issue does not exist, it's for that reason that we are hearing the district try to probe into the merits of what those claims actually are, which, as we know, it's well established is improper for consideration on a plea to the jurisdiction.
So you're saying your pleadings allege a floating quorum? Is that what you're saying?
Pardon me?
Are you saying your pleadings allege a floating quorum?
What I am saying is that we are alleging that the unanimity does suggest that this is private action being taken by the board.
Do you know what a floating quorum is?
Absolutely. A walking quorum, it's maybe a meeting in seriatim, for example.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Is that what your pleadings are alleging? I
believe that's certainly the intent of the pleading. If it's not that specific, that was certainly something that could be addressed. If a pleading sufficiency in the case of special exceptions, that was not something that was really presented until the midnight hour, just as this plea was being decided, and there was never a decision by the lower court on any special exception with respect to pleading sufficiency. But there's, without a doubt, in this case, how in the world could you reach consensus every single time without those walking quorums? And we're 100% confident that the evidence will, in fact, demonstrate that there were walking quorums, no question. In the case of these committees, what we heard was that there's been a legislative exemption. And I think that certainly prompts the question of why in the world would the legislature feel compelled to have to create an exemption if, in the first instance, the law never applied? What we have here is, who is it that's responsible for this district? And to read the legislative intent, or the statute rather, in a consistent manner, what we see is that the water code in both section 51 and in section 49 states that the governing body when it comes to the water district is in fact the board, and it's composed of five members. It makes sense then, in reading the provision 49.064, which the district relies upon as a so-called exemption, that it states that board shall meet regularly, and when it does, the board, the governing body, will be subject to TOMA. In stating that a committee meeting that has less than a quorum can do so without having to come within the confines or strictures of TOMA, that would make sense because there would be no action being taken. All of the action and all of the things that the law was designed to support to benefit the public would continue to come out in the context of the open board meetings. Here, the way this has unfolded is there's been a calculated effort specifically to deprive the benefit of the thinking of the district members. This is not simply just a personal effort with by my client of trying to not understand the way and the inner workings and how this district is working, particularly where it involves a large pipeline project. The public at large is subject to condemnation, authority, and assertions. And open governance is certainly an extremely important issue. You mentioned, Justice Meyer, the outcome of the election, and that there was a campaign based on open governance. And the outcome was, by a multiple, the leading vote getter was the one who had the strongest proponent of open governance. I think that's highly indicative of how important an issue this is to the public. And in this particular case, immunity is just not an issue with respect to the board. When it comes to the committee, if you have the board here, as the statute says, as the governing body, And they've then made the decision to go ahead and relinquish whether it's their authority or delegate or anything else to someone else. How is it that the board should be, as the district suggests, cloaked with the ability to now remove from public view all of the things the statute was designed to protect? That's what this case is about. To adopt the position of the district here is to sanction the ability of districts and therefore other government bodies to be able to simply delegate away to quorums, committees not composed of the governing body's quorum to do all of the work. And then to say, well, we didn't have a quorum of our governing body over there. But what they've done and the way the law has unfolded, as in the Wellman case, to avoid circumvention of the purpose of TOMA, it's merely an extension, a logical extension. If that's what the board chooses to do, fine. If they believe it's more efficient for the committee to go ahead and to be taking and making those decisions, that's fine too. But it then receives a logical extension of the requirements of TOMA to do so openly and in a way that the public can see and understand. That's what Wellman is about. We heard the argument that Wellman was somehow distinguishable on the basis that there wasn't a statement that this committee was not subject to TOMA. But a basic reading of TOMA itself states that for purposes of meetings, open meetings under the statute, a meeting requires the presence of a quorum. And therefore, by definition, it's exactly the same thing we see. There's no conflict between what TOMA says, which is a meeting requires a quorum of the governing body. And yet, to avoid, like in the Wellman case, exactly what would happen, as we're seeing happening with this district, that everything is happening quietly and privately, and then you only have a pro forma and ceremoniously action being taken to adopt, to rubber stamp, or what have you, to publicly come and suggest that we're now making a decision in open. But that's not, this isn't compliance with what the requirements of TOMA actually are. One of the examples I think is particularly appropriate, as we stated in our pleadings. What we see is in trade publications, an announcement of the awardings of tens of millions of dollars in contracts to contractors. But when you review the action of the board itself, there has been no action in a public meeting whatsoever. How was it that that happened? It could only happen where the governing body, and we see in the pleadings itself, where the district would suggest if there's a committee, it doesn't have power and authority. If we have staff members, they're not authorized to do things. And yet there's public announcements of contracts being awards, of grants being issued, without any action by the board whatsoever. And then when you go ahead and scrutinize the record, what we see is it's only then months later, after the fact, that a board meeting is conducted. And you know what happens? There's a presentation, which is unanimously adopted. It's under that second set of circumstances, Judge, that we're not, or Your Honors rather, that we're not suggesting some application of TOMA based upon a statute that says it doesn't apply. What we're saying is the statute itself says that in the case of a water district, TOMA applies to the governing body. The governing body is the board. And in this case where the board apparently has decided that the governing body, whether it's quasi-governing or otherwise, should be something other than the board itself, the TOMA has to be applied, and in fact has been applied in similar circumstances. And there's no law to suggest otherwise, and we haven't heard anything from the district.
Mr. Smith, would you not then, isn't your argument advocating that the definition of governmental body in the way that it's written in the Open Meetings Act, that it should include any subcommittee or committee of a initial governing body that might choose to delegate decision making to some other structured group within that governing body's jurisdiction or authority? I mean, the definition, the TOMA includes a definition of what is a governing body.
A governmental body, that's correct, Your
Honor. Excuse me, governmental body. And it doesn't include the committees that you're talking about.
It can include the committee. The definition can include committees. Yes,
well,
it does.
And I understand that's your contention, but I'm saying when I read the words, I don't see that.
In the statute itself?
Yes, sir.
I think the statute itself includes committees in the definition as well of what constitutes a governmental body, that it can be a board, a commission, a department, a committee, an agency, all within the particular branch, and which can include, you know, a elected or appointed member. And by consequence,
within a branch of the government, that's what that's talking about, and it's talking about the structure of the governing entity that is making the public decision.
Correct.
Okay, but it's not talking about a subcommittee of a committee.
And I agree, and Your Honor, if there is a subcommittee, there's no question, and I think that's exactly what the interpretive law as well as the controlling cases suggest. You can have a subcommittee, and it's okay to have board members on that subcommittee. And it may be that TOMA doesn't apply where you don't have a quorum of the governing body. However, and this is a fact issue, which is significant on a plea to jurisdiction here, where there are facts that suggest that a subcommittee, notwithstanding the lack of a quorum of what may be the governing body under a strict reading sense, when that type of subcommittee then constitutes or takes action much more than merely advisory capacity, that they then take on those same obligations. Otherwise, there's the ability to circumvent the core purpose of TOMA, which is to be construed liberally and applied liberally as well.
All right, I understand your position. I want you to help me deal with just a bit of your pleadings that's on page 9 of your First Amended Petition for declaratory and injunctive relief, in which you're discussing about, in paragraph 27, it's one of the groups you've identified in your pleadings as an action committee, and the statement is made, in addition, they are not presented with sufficient detail to permit TRWD's board members to conduct substantive analysis or dialogue or debate. I'm wondering if your words are not so subjective that they are they're giving us a little less of an objective standard that we might look at to say what it is. In other words, does it have to be a certain volume of paperwork? Does it have to be a certain kind of minutes of presentation that's being made to the deciding body? Or where do we go if what we're getting into is sufficient detail?
Your Honor, I think, I don't know that there can be a bright line test. I think the point, even the Willman case could be somewhat instructive, I think, because one of the points raised there was, in that example, you had a variety of applicants for court appointments, which were considered by the committee. Ultimately, a recommendation was made of simply a short list. Question then is, well, should it have been all of the applicants for consideration
right.
by the board, correct? Or should it have just been the short list, or ultimately the super short list?
Yes, sir.
That was presented. And ultimately, the question came down to that because the decision was being made by the committee and therefore constituted, I think the language was, took on a fundamental role in the decision-making process, which was instructive underlying the underlying current of TOMA itself. That it's that then which would constitute the ability or the application of TOMA.
Well,
and so to answer your
worry,
question,
my concern and worry is this, and that is when we are dealing with application of TOMA and to all of the governmental entities to which it applies, the hundreds, if not maybe a thousand, of city councils in the state of Texas, and when the city council has staff make a presentation and they do a pre-council meeting and then they don't make any decisions and come out in the open and then do make a decision. And we're getting into the question of the sufficiency of the presentation that's made in public. I'm wondering if we're not afoul of the governmental goal of having public decisions made with that and getting into the minutia of the quantity or quality of the presentation that's made to the board before a vote is taken.
And I think you're very important point. I agree. We don't want there to be some kind of a, you know, the government to be coming to a grinding halt, so to speak. But in the cases of applying the strictures of TOMA and its purpose, there's a way in which to solve that. An example, take for example the DFW airport. It has its board. It also has many different, it's composed of many different subcommittees as well. And the decision to resolve that issue was simple. I think the city of Dallas does much of the same thing, which is you make those subcommittee meetings open to the public as well. And where those comply with TOMA in and of itself, which is notice, an opportunity for public to see and attend, there's not an issue because that has now become resolved. And by consequence, if there is an efficient way in which things are delegated, apply the Open Meetings Act law, and it's not a problem. It's resolved. If there's sensitivities, well, TOMA provides legislative exceptions where it's appropriate to keep those within the confines and protected discussions. But that fundamentally underscores the public policy and purpose. It represents the compromise of it should all be open, except there's some limited circumstances which the legislator has decided. And it's that which should be respected, but as compared to allowing delegation to a quasi-governing agency to then, in its own exercise of discretion, deciding what the public does or doesn't get to see.
Thank you, Mr. Smith, for your presentation. Ms. Herman, do you have rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be hopefully brief. Justice Stefano, to your question specifically, the pleadings in this case, unlike most Texas Open Meetings Act challenges, do not allege any surreptitious meetings, do not allege any private conferences occurring between board members, do not allege any improper phone conversations or conferences, do not allege any inappropriate private agreements, and frankly, do not even hint at conspiratorial activities to avoid the requirements that the Open Meetings Act places on the board. And indeed, the plaintiff's proof in the record in this case, and it was filed in connection with a motion to strike the plea to the jurisdiction, demonstrates that in every instance of the 60 instances, and this is the first time I've heard the word 60, they've never before told us what meetings are supposedly being challenged or what activities are supposedly being. In every instance, there was proper disclosure. The Water District operates a website. Everything was posted on the website. All the meetings were open meetings in accordance with the Open Meetings Act. The results of all of the meetings were posted on the website, and they go to the website to construct the exhibit that supposedly identifies all the levels of misconduct, and all it does is demonstrate compliance by the board with the Open Meetings Act. Counsel says, if I heard him correctly, well, why would the legislature create an exemption in the Water Code for activities of committees like the Construction and Operations Committee of the Water District? Well, I guess the why question is probably better suited for the legislature. But beyond that, on a project of this character and projects such as the Trinity River Vision and the construction and maintenance of recreational parks and facilities throughout the Water District's jurisdiction, it seems to me to be pure common sense that the expertise and efficiencies of committees, of professionals who can study and recommend based upon their science how a project can and should be completed, that's probably a valuable source of information. And so if I had to surmise why the legislature would do such a thing, I believe that would be my answer. The other thing I hear is, well,
The board votes were routinely unanimous. I don't know that one can draw an inference of any sort from unanimity among board members who have a common goal and go through the processes that the legislature has recommended. And you certainly can't draw an inference of misconduct simply from the existence of unanimity, I guess, any more than the courts of appeals rendering unanimous decisions. Are we to conclude that because the justices reached a point of unanimity that there must have been some degree of unfairness associated with it?
This may be the wrong court to make that argument.
The Waco court, perhaps. The other thing, and I'm just going to touch very briefly because I didn't quite get there in my opening, the relief, it has to do with the indispensable party argument. The relief that the plaintiff seeks here in his pleading, which he says he has to stand on his pleading, the relief is that the trial court order all of these contracts and actions void or voidable, and order that the funds spent by the regional water district in connection with those activities be returned to the regional water district. How in the world could the trial court void contracts existing with persons and entities who are not parties to the litigation, and at the same time order those non-parties to divest themselves of funds or other property? It simply cannot be done, and consequently I come to the conclusion that the relief that is being requested is outside the scope of the court's jurisdiction, and therefore there is no subject matter jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation, counsel. And Mr. Smith, welcome to Tarrant County. You're always welcome to come for our court, and I appreciate your presentation, and your case is submitted. It will be determined in due order, and you'll hear from the court whenever we have a final opinion for you. And thank you both for coming today. You may be excused.